Okay, so we're here with James Gardner, another mayoral candidate, and we're discussing again the budget this week. And so I want to get into it from a few different angles. But first, I want to understand, like, not where you want to take it or not what you want to do, but how the budget actually works, how you see it. And so my understanding of the budget, and you can correct me or agree or however, is that it's similar, but also dissimilar to how a family might budget, in that we're looking out at that you project out what the revenue is going to be, and then you project out what your income is going to be. And where we've wound up in the past is that we've overestimated, seems purposely, the income, and underestimated purposely the expense. And so the way it worked is every year we would go along this, we'd go through this exercise, and then at some point in the year, run out of money, and then suddenly you're drawing from your cash reserves or getting money from somewhere. And as I understand it now, we've reached a point where there's no longer any cash reserves to draw from, and so we finally sort of kicked the can down the road to its end. So I'm going to open it up to you to discuss sort of the history of that, the process, and clarify or correct anything that I've said.
Sure. Well, my understanding is I think that's about right. You know, the Common Council obviously plays a role. You know, the mayor sort of proposes the budget, and the Common Council can make adjustments on the expense side, is my understanding, before adopting it. They can't fiddle with anticipated revenues. So the mayor can propose a budget and say, you know, we expect to get, you know, our estimated property tax revenue, our net of $110 million or $101 million, whatever it is. The Common Council can't say, well, actually, we think you're only going to get 90, or we think you're going to get 140 net million dollars out of your property taxes. So what they can do as the Common Council is say, we're not going to fund this expense. We're not going to fund this program. We're not going to agree to this these hires, or however the expense side of the ledger. So there is, I would say it's not an equal relationship, the way that it doesn't have as many checks and balances as maybe the federal system does, but the Common Council definitely plays a role in it. And I think you're exactly right in terms of, it's always been this sort of game of patting themselves, you know, whether it was Byron Brown or, well, it's been Byron Brown for forever, sort of patting themselves and the acting mayor, Chris Gallen, sort of doing the same thing, priding themselves on sort of achieving a balanced budget. But when you start looking at the numbers and measuring those numbers against the actual budget from, you know, from the years previous, you begin to see what we'll generously call assumptions don't carry any weight. And that's sort of where we've been, and that's where we are today, is the proposed and adopted budget for the fiscal year 25 to 26 sort of has a lot of assumptions based into it that aren't based in not only historical evidence, but defy expectations, defy all, anybody looking at them could say these, you know, the idea that overtime costs are suddenly going to go down when, in point of fact, they've only ever increased. That is how you get to these phony numbers that this administration came out with, is they just, you can see going line by line, realized, oh, we have to adjust some of these numbers, and they did it. When in truth, historically, looking back, those numbers have been pretty constant or have been growing over time. So that's sort of how we got into the mess that we're in now. Obviously, Byron Brown was the beneficiary, and you hate to say that anybody was the beneficiary of COVID, but receiving, you know, over $300 million in ARPA unrestricted funds basically allowed him to paper over all of these glaring deficiencies for years. And they used what would have been fantastic. Unrestricted funds are almost unheard of from the federal government, by the way. So these are things that normally federal funding, when it comes in, it's tied to roads or it's tied to specific projects, community development grants, things that have to be used for a specific purpose, which makes sense. This was free money. All of what we could have done, we could have fundamentally changed the way Buffalo looks with that. And instead, what it was used for was to plug budget holes and to hire a bunch of people who work in City Hall. That's what those funds went toward. And, you know, that's a hard reality to take, but that's sort of where we are. And as you said, the can can't be kicked any further because we don't have that pool of funds to use any longer. So we're really legitimately in financial duress because there's nothing to plug the holes.
Mm-hmm. I want to go back to one of the things you mentioned there, and that was the Common Council, having to vote on it and essentially having, you know, some oversight but not full oversight of the budget. One of the things that came up when we were talking to Rashid Wyatt in the primaries was he had mentioned that he was the only one to vote against the budget in the Common Council. Has there been a situation where the Common Council, I honestly don't know, where they've kicked it back to the mayor and said, no, this is nonsense?
I think what you normally see is, again, you see a proposed budget and an adopted budget. And this is the other thing that's very important for people to understand. There are actually three flavors of budget. You get the proposed that the mayor comes out with. You get the adopted that the Common Council approves. And then after June, well, like this year, so after June, the city's fiscal year ended in June of 25, this past June. Now they're undergoing sort of an audit, right? So they actually audit their expenses and revenues from the previous years, and you get the actual budget. And those are the numbers that are actually important because there's no fudging those. And that's why moving forward, it's so important. And what I've done in sort of analyzing the budget is to look at not the proposed, not the adopted, the actual, because that's where people have gone through and made sure, okay, what did the city actually take in? What did the city actually spend? And that's what's instructive. Now, in terms of the Common Council's oversight, my understanding is that with every proposed budget, they chisel away something, right? Or whether they increase one thing or they fiddle with numbers here or numbers there. My guess is there is some tinkering that happens, but I think by and large, you're right in that it's essentially rubber stamped. There seems to have been, at least in my lifetime, I haven't heard of any huge budget battle other than I remember, I think it was sort of tied into the when we did the whole speed camera issue. Mm-hmm. I think it sort of reared its head at that point. I know there was a lot of Common Council blowback on Byron Brown over that. But by and large, I think that's why it's not really you don't have this sort of equality in station between the mayor's office and the Common Council's office when it comes to the budget process.
Okay. And then just to help myself understand it and anybody that's listening understand it. So once you get to that actual budget, that's retroactive for the
retrospective.
Yeah. So retrospective, looking at the prior year, like we imagined that we were going to spend $1 million on X and we actually spent six.
Correct. Or in our case, instead of $1 million, the city spent 2.5. Yeah. Right. I mean, that, and so we're probably going to get those numbers for the 2025 so for the 24-25 budget, probably within the month. I imagine it'll be in October. And I imagine you're going to see that the budget deficit is bigger than we thought. That's what we're expecting. And that's what the numbers sort of forecast, because again, when they come out with the budget book, this is the best part. They come out with a budget book that sort of shows you what the year to date expenses and revenues have been. So you kind of have a snapshot of where things are as of that date. And you can easily see that some of the assumptions of what the next year's expenses and revenues were going to be didn't match up even with the 11-year or the 11-month funding levels that that the mayor and the common council approved. So, I mean, there we're going to be, I anticipate that, you know, when I get sworn in January, there's going to be at least a $50 million budget deficit that has to be closed immediately. And unless you do something to address that, it's only going to get progressively more out of control.
So now we're at that point. So let's say, so how, first off, I guess explain if the budget process itself could actually be changed. What would you do? What would that look like?
I think, I mean, you know, I think whether the process itself needs to change is an interesting one. I think that would require probably some level of, you know, revision of the charter and everything else. But I think what has to happen is you have to deal with real numbers. You have to deal with, and you have to be honest about what your revenues are and what your expenses are going to be. And I think there's at least, you know, we did this, the forum, for lack of a better word, down at the Theater of Youth in Allentown a couple of days ago. And one of the big questions there was whether or not the city has a spending problem or a revenue problem. And the truth is, we have both. A lot of my two opponents, I think, came down on the idea that we don't have a spending problem. That's just undermined by the black and white numbers that we have in the actual budget. If you look at the fiscal year from 23 to 24 and 25, 22 to 23 and 23 to 24, city expenses grew 30%. 30% in 2 years. If you look at personnel costs from fiscal year 23 ending 24, personnel costs grew 11%. We're anticipating that in this this current budget that will be audited, we'll get the figures in October, it grew another 5. That's 16% increases in personnel costs. What does that mean in actual dollars and cents? When you factor in salary and the 42% fringe benefit package, that means almost $50 million in personnel costs in 2 years. That's absolute, and you can't find a resident in the city of Buffalo who believes that the quality of their services have increased over the past 2 years. These are people who were added to the payroll at, you know, whether it was through Byron Brown or Chris Scanlon, however it worked out, when everybody knows and common counselors can't say that they didn't know that this fiscal cliff was coming, everybody knew it was coming, including the mayor. Everybody knew it. And still they approved $50 million in new salaries. That is the type of fiscal mismanagement that we've just accepted in the city of Buffalo. And then there's this sort of expectation that, well, we're going to get out of it somehow. Well, there isn't some, you know, what do they call that? Deus ex machina, like some Greek god that's going to come down and save us here. You have to really address the spending side before you can do anything. Because if you're going to expect any kind of bailout from the state or any kind of other level of government, who's giving us money right now? We look like a terrible investment. You know, you're heading off this fiscal cliff and you hire $50 million in new salaries, it's ludicrous. Until you address the expense side of the ledger, no one's going to bail us out. And it's just common budgetary sense. You're going to have to make some, what I call right-sizing of how City Hall is functioning, because otherwise we're going to be, the city will declare bankruptcy. And whatever that means, I don't know. I assume it'll mean a hard control board, which will do nobody any good. And that's not where we should be as a city when there are clear pathways out of this mess. You just have to make the hard decisions in order to get there.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we have, you know, absolutely relied on the Greek gods historically to come down and
save us. And it's worked. I mean, I can't imagine what Byron Brown's sense of relief must have been when the federal government came in with a $330 million check. I just can't believe it. He must have been like, thank you. I mean, man, it just, he must have, I don't know. The sense of relief he must have felt is.
And it's my understanding too, that we actually have had to return some funds. Like we returned $1 million in money that was supposed to go towards lead paint abatement. There was money that was supposed to go, I believe, towards more of the Main Street.
So that's another layer of just how badly the city's been managed. The city is bonded out for road work, mm-hmm. and they haven't spent the money that they have in with the bonds. So like we're not even doing all the necessary road and street repair that we have bonded out. That's how mismanaged this whole City Hall has been. We're not fully utilizing the federal funds that we get for our streets, and we're not. It's not a question of bonding more. It's a question of spending the money that we've already got raised through bonds. We're not even doing that. We're holding it. We're holding the money. That money's restricted. You can't just, plug that to the budget hole. That has a specific purpose. And it's like that level of mismanagement is, it is incredibly frustrating to bear witness to.
Yeah. And I think, I think anybody, like we read about this kind of stuff in the paper or hear about it, and it's almost too mind-blowing to even comprehend. Like, I don't even understand how it happens. Like, I feel like these kind of decisions almost have to be purposeful as opposed to, like, mistakes.
Well, it's just when there's no accountability, this is what happens. There's no one's scared that they're going to lose their jobs. I mean, that would be an interesting thing to foil. How many people have actually been fired from City Hall in the past 2 decades? I guarantee you it's, single digits? I mean, there's no culture of accountability. There's no culture of responsiveness. And that, it shows itself in the political side. You see whole swaths of the city that are just sort of taken for granted. Politicians don't go to it. Their legislators don't show up for it. I see it, all, and it's not just over on the east side, it's over the west. I mean, South Buffalo also, like there are parts of the valley where you go down there and they see houses that have been boarded up and rats have been, exploding in population. And it's just, there's just this expectation or this understanding that people are just going to take it and continue to vote the way that they've always voted. And until you fundamentally wake people up and shake the ground, that's what you're going to get. You're going to get this level of service, because if you don't make them pay for it, they'll continue to give it to you.
Yeah. I mean, I was certainly, I think you can look at it with, any city that's gone through a period of decline, and Detroit is certainly more of a visible example of it than Buffalo, but you can travel around Buffalo and there is really neighborhoods have I mean, it's easy to say, oh, it's the people that live there, it's their fault for these things happening and the neighborhood's declining. But it really is a systemic kind of political abandonment of certain neighborhoods. And so I would agree with that. So I want to get into just like going forward, like, you know, here's where we are. You know, what are some of the things you would change? And then also, do you think it's possible for Buffalo to generate enough revenue to not be in this position year after year?
So here are some startling statistics that I found. The city of Buffalo raises through its property taxes $180 million a year. Okay, that's all we get. So that's everybody's tax bill, businesses, residences, everybody that has to pay a tax bill. The city grosses $180 million. 37% of that right off the top goes to the Buffalo Board of Education. So Buffalo Public Schools gets $70 million of that $180 million, which leaves the city of Buffalo with $110 million from property taxes. If you add up the cost of healthcare for retirees, the cost of healthcare for current employees, and our pension liability, you get $162 million. Our property taxes don't even cover the bill for health insurance and pensions. That's why I say you can't tax your way out of this problem. You can't raise taxes enough to even cover the shortfall of healthcare and pension. And if you attempted to do it, you're only going to exacerbate the problem of everyone leaving, because you can't raise taxes 40% and expect people to stay around. Businesses already are getting taxed at twice the rate the residences are. So, and if you talk to most business owners in the city, no one's saying, yeah, business is great. They just aren't. Because their costs are, every element of their cost structure is going up, whether it's, you know, buying the stuff that they need or the cost of their taxes just to be in existence. So when you look at it in that, from that perspective, you realize that this isn't something where, you know, the city can easily escape this. I mean, by far and away, we are, our greatest source of revenue is through direct state aid. And that has been that way forever, probably, at least in my lifetime. The thing that's kind of annoying is that everyone understands that costs have gone up. The amount of state aid has stayed relatively flat. So we're not getting more money from New York State. We've been getting the same amount of money from New York State while all of our costs are increasing. And we, as I said, we haven't done ourselves any great favors by how we've spent the money that we have gotten. So that's why it's the first step, my first step is we have to show that we're a good investment. We have to show the people who are going to help us get out of this mess, whether it's New York State or the federal government, that we're serious about keeping our fiscal house in order, which is why, you know, we're going to have to, as I say, right-size government. And what that means is I've sort of looked through the budget and we've sort of identified $30 million in savings that we can realize almost immediately. And part of that, it's not just slash and burn, everybody gets fired and laid off. That's not it at all. What it means is, take the snowplows, for example. We have 1,600 lane miles to plow in the city of Buffalo. We have, on per this budget book, we have 25 snowplows to accomplish that task. It's an open question whether all 25 of them work, but we have 25 of them for 1,600 lane miles. The town of West Seneca has 240 lane miles. They have 16 snowplows. So the city of Buffalo is expected to plow the additional 1,300 lane miles of roadway with 10 extra snowplows. Those are black and white figures. And if you talk to the people who are working down at the Broadway Barns, they'll say, yeah, we need more equipment. Those are capital expenditures. You can bond out for a new snowplow. We can get those trucks. You amortize it over 30 years. Probably costs an additional $2 million. But you know what's even more important than that? Our mechanics. Because if you, anytime you put one of those huge snowplows out there in the middle of a snowstorm, a bunch of them are going to come back with something wrong with them. And what they've been really struggling to do is keep their dispatch rate high. Because they don't pay very well down there. And what happens is every time there's an opening at West Hur or Northtown, your mechanics leave. And it has had severe consequences in terms of the city's ability to ultimately plow our roads, because we don't have the few trucks we have, we're not able to dispatch because they're not working. So I would actually propose that we need to increase the salaries of, increase the salary offerings for the mechanics who are going to be servicing city-owned trucks and resources. That's money well spent. But do we need, you know, some of the other hires that have been made over the past 2 years? We're going to have to really take a hard look at that. And that will get us to, if you're able to realize those $30 million in savings, it does two things. One, that's half the budget hole that you've closed. It also shows potential investors that you're serious about running a more efficient, leaner government, which every investor wants to see. The other thing the city of Buffalo needs to do a much better job of is collecting its unpaid debts. You've got people who, you know, the New York State has basically said you can't suspend people's registration for unpaid parking tickets or, you know, traffic fines or things like that. And look, we can debate the wisdom of that, but one of the unintended consequences is that people no longer feel that they need to pay parking tickets, and they no longer need to pay their traffic summonses. That's a large chunk of the city's budget that used to be there that isn't there any longer. Setting aside issues with housing court, where you see, you know, and I've heard it from both sides. You hear it from landlords who are like, I've got, you know, a tenant that's been stuck in my house for 18 months, paid me first and last month's rent, and I haven't seen another nickel. I can't get them out because housing court's so backed up. There's no relief in sight. And then you hear it from tenants who say, you know, I've got this terrible landlord who, you know, won't do anything about the chipping paint or the other issues that housing court violations. We should be, that's something that I would be petitioning OCA for, to have an additional housing court judge.
OCA, just...
Oh, Office of Court Administration. Sorry. Okay. So ultimately, the city, as mayor, I wouldn't have any control over how many judges there are, what they get assigned. But if you look up the largest fatted calves in New York State, the Office of Court Administration is way up there. They have money to literally light on fire, and the idea that they can't give us an additional housing court judge is the most bizarre thing to me I've ever heard. And for a city of 277,000 that's in supposedly dealing with a landlord crisis, an absentee landlord crisis, and housing court crisis, you know, what an easy thing. Maybe don't even make it permanent. Have at least a deputized second housing court judge to deal with the backlog rather. But if you start doing a better job of collecting those unpaid debts, together with the $30 million in savings, you begin to show, that budget hole begins to shrink. Again, you make yourself a more compelling case for asking for additional aid from New York State, which I think we're going to need one way or the other. And then the third thing is, if you do find the need to deficit bond, you have to tie that bond to revenue. This is the other great thing that I hear, you know, Sean Ryan talk about, is we're going to borrow $150 million. And we're gonna restructure our municipal debt, just like you would with your credit card debt. That's not the way municipal finance works. First of all, the city of Buffalo already has $157 million in long-term debt. So you would effectively be doubling it. $300 million without any idea of how to pay for it. Even if you could do it, even if you could convince the city comptroller to issue those bonds, and by the way, she fought Chris Scanlon tooth and nail over bonds that were largely reimbursable from the federal government in terms of Buffalo Public School bonds and school bonds and road bonds. So those were bonds that the city was asking to borrow a whole bunch of money for, but those bonds were going to be covered by outside funding sources, so the city really wasn't going to be on the hook for them. This is money that the city's going to be on the hook for no matter what they do, right? And if you, so even if you could, even if she would agree to issue those bonds, who is buying them? No one is going to buy a bond, a loan, without any expectation that it's going to be paid back. So my plan would be, if you find yourself in a situation where you have to deficit bond, I would use the revenue from those parking garages that Chris Scanlon seems so eager to sell that generate the city about $5 million a year. If you take half of that revenue, $2 million, and pledge that to bond $30 million worth of bonds, it works, and you've closed your budget hole. And that's the kind of creative thinking that you need to have when it comes to dealing with a problem of this magnitude. Because if we don't address it now, if we don't start winnowing this deficit down, it's only going to balloon. And that means we're going to get into a hard control board, which I don't know whether people sort of remember how that works, but I guarantee you the people who are in public sector unions do. Because what it means is police, fire, all the civil service unions that represent City Hall, their step increases are frozen. Their MOAs, their Memorandum of Agreement on healthcare and all of that disappear. And basically what happens is the control board tells the mayor, you've got to cut this amount. Don't care how you do it, you just got to do it. And you end up laying off police officers and firemen. That's not the way a mayor should. A mayor should be somebody who wants to solve the problem, recognize it, solve the problem, and deal with it. You shouldn't have to rely on some third party, the control board, which is entirely unelected, doing the dirty work for you. You should do it yourself. And what I've said from the very beginning is, you know, when it comes to the public sector unions, we're going to have to sit down and we're going to have to negotiate in good faith from their end and from mine how we're going to address some of their legacy costs, because they don't want a control board either. They know what the city's finances are. They will want to work with whoever they will want to work with me in order to make sure that we get a fair deal that acknowledges the city's financial situation while also protecting their membership and being able to recruit new police officers, new firemen. That you have to have these people being brought on even in tough budget times, because you can't come down to a point 10 years down the road and everyone's retired and you have minimum manpower requirements and suddenly you just got to hire a whole bunch of people off the street, give them a gun and a badge and say, welcome to the police force. It's not good for anybody.
That brings up sort of one other thing that I want to get into, and you started to touch on this. What are some of the like specific growing costs in the city of Buffalo, and how do we address those?
Well, I think as I mentioned, one of the issues that we're seeing is obviously over the past two fiscal years, you've had this sort of 16% increase in personnel costs. And that obviously cannot continue. And I'm not calling for everybody that got hired over the past 2 years to get fired. it doesn't work that way. And even with retirements and everything else, it doesn't necessarily realize the savings that you otherwise would. A lot of the fixed costs that the city has are things like healthcare. I mean, healthcare costs are ballooning for the city, as they are for probably every other business, and that's a problem that's largely outside the city's control, right? The city sort of is self-insured in the sense that it bundles everybody together, and then it sends the labor pool, the healthcare out to bid, and insurance companies bid on that contract. I think something that we need to sort of seriously look at is whether we need to split healthcare from pharmaceuticals, from prescriptions. Maybe we need a standalone prescription policy that helps realize some cost savings there, because healthcare costs are only going up. Personnel costs are only going up. We need good people to do the city's work, but we have to be very mindful of, every dollar of salary that the city pays, we pay an additional 42 cents in benefits. So, I mean, that's a very rich benefit package. So there are, and that's part of what makes working for the city attractive. The reality is, everything has to be considered as we move forward. So, and apart from that, you look at a lot of you look around the city and you see deferred maintenance everywhere you look. And so it's not a situation where they've been spending like drunken sailors for the past 20 years and everything's in really good shape. It's not it at all. They've been spending 20 million, over 20 years like a drunken sailor, and none of it has gone toward the long-term growth of the city or putting any of our infrastructure in a better state. So we're going to have some real challenges with respect to not only addressing those rising costs, but also being able to fulfill the core functions that people expect from the city. That's the challenge, and I'm completely ready for it.
One of the other things that that I see, and it's a challenge. So I don't think there's an easy answer to this, but with all the vacant land in the city of Buffalo, let's say the city owned property, like mm-hmm. how do we actually like realistically start to get some of that land back on the tax rolls? And the reason I say it's complicated is because we also don't have, 50,000 people moving here a year,
Well, here's the thing. And this is so how, one of the other ways that we're going to, it's not just about cutting our way out of this, and it's not just about making sure that we, realize that we collect every other, everybody's overdue parking notices and things like that. The other tenet of my proposal is, my plan is, we have to grow our way out of it. Everyone talks about how Buffalo has an affordability. We're probably the only city in America that has an affordability problem and an urban prairie in the same location. If you go around Sycamore and Genesee and Broadway, there are whole swaths of city blocks that are just open, and not only that, but they're covered in garbage. They're covered basically what happens is, I think the city streets department just mows the garbage that gets piled in the lots, and it's terrible. It's terrible for the people who live there. And if you drive down those residential streets, these aren't people who are, the people that live there, that's their home. And the vast majority of those houses are well-maintained. People take a tremendous amount of pride in their neighborhood. And the problem is that the city doesn't show the same level of pride for their neighborhood. And what I think we need to do is move away from this idea of affordable rental homes. The affordable housing development that the city of Buffalo has engaged in does nothing to lift people out of generational poverty. It has, I mean, if you look down at the Perry projects, or not the, not the Perry projects, but the affordable housing that they just built down on Perry Street, each one of those units costs in excess of $550 million for a rental. The person who goes and lives there doesn't own anything. They're sitting there, and that their apartment cost half a five. I mean, it's just, it's an insane amount of money that, that New York State just handed over to build rentals. That is, and then the times that we do engage in affordable single family home development, the city's patting it, you know, all these elected officials are patting themselves on the back for 47 affordable single family homes for sale in the city of Buffalo. 47. Now, I can say with certainty that there are 11 homes under construction on Adams Street, which is off of Jefferson. Those 11 homes from have been under, so the RFP for those homes were was issued 4 years ago. They're over $1 million over budget, and not a single house is built. That's how we've, that's how the city, that's how the state does property development. And it's inexcusable. It's a joke is what it is. And they're running around with ribbon cuttings and podiums, patting themselves on the back. Well, we've got 47 houses under construction. Well, we should be doing 47 a year is what we need. And if you look over there, when it, and I don't think the city's role in this is, you know, acting as a property developer. My idea is, let's clear the title to these tracts of land. Let's make sure that all the infrastructure to the mains is in good working order. And let's partner with developers and affordable housing developers to build a mix, the mix of housing that the city needs. We don't just need affordable housing after affordable housing, low-income housing after low-income housing. We need all the variety of housing, whether it's the high end, middle end, and the low end. Everybody, and we have to stop as a city sort of warehousing poor people. We have to stop doing that. It doesn't help anybody. It doesn't. You should want to live. Everyone will be the beneficiary of diverse neighborhoods in terms of not only, you know, what you can see in terms of race and religion, but also socioeconomics. It'd do a wonderful thing for the Buffalo Public Schools and other educational options. You want mixed income neighborhoods. And if you're so focused on, you know, sort of building these, you know, every, I don't know, 5 years, you put 11 homes on the rolls, that's doing nothing. You have to, it has to be a much grander plan, a much grander vision. And if you look at Erie County as a whole, there's a going to be, if we're not already there, a shortage in land available for residential development. I mean, you talk to property developers on what they're spending for housing lots in Hamburg and Orchard Park, it's north of $200,000. My plan would be, look it, we've cleared the title. We've, you know, you're going to have it free and clear, you know, to develop homes or commercial buildings, whatever it is that we're going to develop here. We will hold, we're not getting any property tax income from it right now, and we'll hold on to it until you sell it. But by partnering with development, and again, from affordable to market rate development, if the city provides that level of service to be a partner with that development, I think you're going to see the sort of sea change that everybody has been waiting for the past 50 years, 60 years. And it's doable, but you can't just be, you know, waiting for New York State and the governor, Kathy Hochul, to come in and say, well, we're going to build another 25 homes here. You need private development to come in and do a lot of this, because otherwise it's going to be another four generations where nothing else is going to happen.
I would say, you know, just as my sort of boots on the ground in real estate, I would absolutely agree that I think that the strain on the housing market is in all segments of the market,
yeah,
across the board. And just an interesting thing that I read somewhere, I wish I could remember where it was, but that in the that neighborhoods actually used to be much more economically diverse than they are now. That they were, you know, neighborhoods were tighter. There was the businesses you needed were in there, but also the socioeconomic status of a lot of these neighborhoods, which we think of, you know, obviously there were very poor neighborhoods and then there was very rich neighborhoods, but a lot of it was much more mixed than
we absolutely understand. And so, the idea that you're going to create sort of commercial development without residential density is moronic. Yeah. You have to have the houses first. That's how we're going to get ourselves out of this long-term budget problem. It's also how we're going to get people out of generational poverty, because when they own their own home, they have an asset. They have an asset to provide to their kids and a stable environment for those kids to grow up in. And that is the essence of the American dream. And it just, for whatever reason, that part of the American dream doesn't apply to Buffalo, New York.
Well, thanks for the conversation, and I look forward to continuing this next week.
Great.